Coming to you from NARM, Melbourne, on ABC Radio National, this is Life Matters. Hello, I'm Beverly Wang. And this Existential Friday, and in contrast to world events, let's talk about making love, not war. So please consider this your content warning as well. As we head into the sealed section, we're going to talk about sex. And let me ask you, if you had to rank your sex life between 1 and 10, where would you land? If your number is on the low side, guess what? You are an average Australian. And in about 40 minutes' time, the aunties talk through a relationship revelation from beyond the grave. Let's talk. Today, a whole smorgasbord of sexual experiences is just an online search away. From role play to ethical non-monogamy, it's all out there. But despite that, a recent survey found that while 74% of Australians feel loved, only 53% are satisfied with their sex lives. So what's going on? I've got two sexologists standing by to help you figure out how to ask for what you want when it comes to sex and intimacy. And if you're one of the millions hooked on the queer Canadian sports drama Heated Rivalry, we'll also explore what that viral phenomenon might reveal about what's happening in our own bedrooms. And welcome to Cam Fraser. He's the deputy chair of the Society of Australian Sexologists. He's also a qualified sex coach. Hi, Cam.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Tanya Coons is a clinical sexologist who sees clients and teaches therapists how to work with sexual issues. Hello, Tanya.
Hey, Beverly.
Now, Tanya and Cam can answer your questions and offer general advice. But Tanya, let me start with you. You've been talking to Australians about their sex lives for more than 20 years. What are you hearing from people at the moment?
I think that statistic that you popped up was correct. There are a lot of people who are not satisfied with their sex lives, and they actually don't know what to do about it. So a lot of people are turning off rather than turning on or tuning in to each other.
Cam, you've run seminars on everything from being more present in the bedroom to increasing confidence. What are you hearing from your clients?
Well, I specifically work with male clients, and a lot of the things that I hear from them is an experience of performance anxiety. They're wanting to connect with their partners. They're wanting to have more pleasure. They're wanting to be more intimate, but they're, similar to what Tanya was sharing, unsure how to go about doing that, and they're feeling really stuck.
Cam, have you noticed a change over time in terms of how people feel about sex and performance?
With the clients that I have, and I suppose there's a bit of a selection bias there, they definitely are experiencing more anxiety over the last couple of years. And there's probably a variety of reasons for that, which we can get into. But there is an increasing desire to want to connect, to want to be intimate, to want to explore more pleasure together. And because that's conflicting with or contrasting with their views around masculinity, it's causing them a lot of kind of internal tension and internal anxiety.
What about you, Tanya? I guess what's your longitudinal view about why people are reaching out to get help from you, and also this change in, you know, nearly half of Australians not feeling satisfied?
I wholeheartedly agree with the things that Cam said. I also am seeing that, yes, people, they're getting messages about sex. It might be at porn that they're looking at. It might be cultural messages. But there's no encouragement to speak openly and honestly. So there's a lot of shame around wanting things, wanting specific activities, or not knowing. So the levels of anxiety are very high. I have had quite a few times mothers ringing up and making appointments for their teenage sons because they're so anxious about sex and letting partners down or having people talk about them. So there's this huge expectation of things to do. And then the messages that are commonly able to be accessed aren't very helpful for everybody, but particularly young men, because it tells them that they're supposed to know what to do, when to do it, and how to do it with no instruction. And the sex education that we're given in this country is still pretty poor, and most people are kind of anatomically ignorant around folks with vulvas and their arousal. So if you own one or if you play with one, there can be lack of understanding that can lead to frustrations and difficulties with people's sex lives.
We have a first listener call, Mary in Narm. Welcome to Life Matters. What's your response to the question I put out about how you're feeling about your sex life?
Hi. Yeah, I just sort of saw it and I felt more that I'm not dissatisfied, but I suspect my partner is. My sex drive has dropped off a lot in the past 2 years of our relationship, but the opposite has sort of seemed to happen to him. He's ready to go really any time, and I feel like I'm rejecting their advances a lot because I'm still not in the mood, and I still love them. I'm very attracted to them. And I feel so bad about the rejection, and I sort of end up having duty sex sort of a lot because I don't want them to feel like I'm not attracted to them or to let them down as a partner.
I think this is a very common experience that many couples can relate to. Thank you so much for sharing, Mary. I'll still keep you on the line, but I want to bring Tanya in for a moment. Partners at different, I suppose, speeds of their libido and interest in sex. That must happen so much, Tanya.
It does. It does. One thing that we can expect in life is that individually our libidos will wax and wane. So they're constantly going up and down. And when you bring a partner into that, it's very rare that people are totally in sync. That usually happens at the beginning of a relationship where you've got limerence happening, there's lots of hormones making it much more possible to get to sex easily and to be playful and experimental. But then when we start to fold life in, a lot of things start to run interference with people's ability or willingness to be sexual or feel sexual. So I was interested that our caller mentioned duty sex. I had a chat to the ABC just recently about this. They're right. There's a lot of that sort of thing going on. And sometimes I like to sort of reframe that and say, if you've got kids, for example, you know, I would say, did you take your kids to the zoo these holidays? And people are like, yes, I did. And I'm like, do you love the zoo? And they're like, no, I don't. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, how come you took them to the zoo? Well, I love my kids. And we can put that into things in the bedroom. It might be that instead of waiting for that tingling in the loins to feel really sexy, we can make decisions about doing gentle and intimate things with our partner, things that we know we'll enjoy and things that we know will lead to connection and pleasure.
Mary, can I ask, when you have this duty sex, which Tanya has affirmed happens quite a lot, Are you still able to ask for what you want? You know, is it pleasurable? Is it still kind of a good time once you kind of get into it?
Yeah, it is. And my partner is always asking what I want and things like that. We're very collaborative in that way. But it's just the initial part. I just don't feel like it at all. And sometimes, you know, I'd rather it be done kind of quickly.
Yeah.
But other times I really enjoy it and I do feel very satisfied. So it's either way.
Yeah. I mean, it waxes and wanes. And so it's kind of like, Cam, do you, I wonder if I could bring you in here as well and just speak to this idea of duty sex as well, if you can add to anything that Tanya has said or what Mary is sharing.
Yes, one of the things that I will encourage my clients to work on is what I'll call their erotic menu. And I find that when couples are wanting to be intimate, wanting to be sexual with one another, very often one of the only things that is on the table is penetrative sex, is intercourse. And I kind of think of this as like when you're going to eat a meal with your partner, you go to the restaurant and you choose from this menu a dish that you want to eat. And for a lot of couples, when they are horny and wanting to be intimate with one another, the only dish that's on their erotic menu is intercourse. So adding other dishes to your erotic menu, adding variety to the way that you're able to have your sexual needs met and the way you're able to explore sexuality with one another is a valuable thing to do to mitigate the potential obligation that you feel to engage in one particular sex act. So I'm a big fan of variety being the spice of life and variety also being the spice of our sex life, but that comes from an open line of communication around what are some other ways that we can be intimate with one another that doesn't have to look a particular way. So rather than getting hung up on what sex has to look like, can we just focus on just being in enjoyment, in pleasure with one another in whatever way that might look? So adding that into the mix is something that I like to encourage my clients to do.
And Mary, I just want to come back to you for a second, because I want to step back from the duty sex and just think about when you're not having sex. Do you feel comfortable in the regular times to raise, I suppose, your sex drive dropping off, your lack of interest in sex? Is that a conversation that you feel comfortable having in just regular times?
Yeah, it's something we've discussed a few times, but I think that their sort of body isn't really listening to what our conversations are, so they're sort of still ready to go, and I don't know, we're kind of stuck at a bit of a standstill, and I really appreciate how like attracted they are to me and all of that. So yeah, it's a bit of a tough one. It feels like we have had the chats, but the bodies have different plans, sort of thing.
Bodies have different plans, absolutely. Tanya, final words from you to Mary before we keep going?
I'd kind of like to piggyback on what Cam said, and it's really looking at what is possible. I think so many times people find it really difficult to talk about what we're about to do right now, and we can have a quick conversation, what are you up for? And it could be like, you know what, I'm tired and I've got to get up early tomorrow to go to the gym. And maybe, you know, maybe I don't need to have an orgasm tonight. Or maybe can we just spend 5 minutes? Or maybe could we focus on pleasure for one of us, not both of us? But work out what might work in this moment. It doesn't mean you have to do that every single time. It's just we're talking about now. It could be as simple as, darling, I went to the hairdresser. Don't muck up my hair today. You know, tomorrow you can pull my hair and say giddy up, but not today. Right? Yeah. Things can be very specific for what you're feeling and how you're feeling. So it can leave room for even gentle connection, because there's nothing wrong with suggesting, how about we make out on the sofa for 15 minutes? That's enough for me today. You know, or 5 minutes even. You know, it's keeping that connection going that's really important.
Mary, thank you so much for being our first listener to add to the conversation today, and hope that's helpful, and wishing you all the best.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Let's keep going, because Stormy is in regional Victoria. Welcome to Life Matters, Stormy. What do you want to share about how you're feeling about your sex life?
Well, it's twofold. I've learned a lot from my partners. I'm a gay woman, and I have experienced a lot of pleasure solo. Intimacy and self-pleasuring is very important. My former girlfriend and I discussed a lot of techniques about self-pleasuring. And when we have those frank and honest and loving discussions, we didn't stay together, but we, for various reasons, but nothing, it was amicable. And we discovered that self-pleasure is important, because I was having trouble with orgasm, and she actually coached me through how to improve that experience alone. And I've got to say that it's worked a treat.
Is it possibly life-changing, Stormy?
It is, actually, because, you know, I find even when I'm flirting with love interests, that sometimes tactile, you were talking about other ways of stimulation and gentle touch, even when it comes over, that was innocent, even to me sometimes, there is such a surge of pleasure in that and arousal. You don't have to be doing the sexual act when you're together with somebody, because you actually, it's a multifaceted thing. It's an emotional field. It's a physical and tactile field. And I must say, I love flirting.
I love that you love that, Stormy. Thank you so much for sharing. You have a fabulous day. Thank you so much for all of your interest. So many texts coming in. This is ABC Radio National on Life Matters. I'm Beverly Wang. And if you didn't hear it at the top, you might have gleaned from the calls just then that today's Existential Friday conversation comes with a content advisory, because we are talking about sex, intimacy, and adult relationship. The survey tells us that nearly half of Australians are unhappy with their sex lives. So today I'm asking, what is your pleasure struggle? How are you feeling about your sex life? Do you need help figuring out how to ask for what you want when it comes to sex and intimacy? And as we heard from one of our earlier callers, it may be actually talking about what you you don't want as well. I've got Cam Fraser. He's a qualified sex coach and deputy chair of the Society of Australian Sexologists, as well as Tanya Coons, a clinical sexologist who teaches therapists how to work with sexual issues. Now, the calls started off quick today. I need to get back to you, Tanya and Cam. Cam, you've got a personal connection to this topic. How did challenges during sex first show up for you?
Yeah, so as a teenager, I was really struggling with my both sexual function, but also my sexual connection with the people that I was being intimate with. And, you know, I was bouncing from premature ejaculation to erection issues. And the way that I was approaching sex was very much from a, let's say, you know, quantity over quality perspective as a teenage boy and as a younger man. The anxiety that I had about performing well, of like having a type of sex, was really quite pronounced. And it made me, as I said, very anxious about my sexual experiences and doing the right thing. And one of the ways that I managed that anxiety throughout my collegiate years as a student in college was to just drink, I suppose, to just get intoxicated. And my reasoning for kind of doing that was, well, if I can just get drunk enough, then if I don't perform very well, if I don't have very good sex, then I can just blame the alcohol. I can just have this scapegoat. And the shift for me around that was to start to go to therapy, to be honest with you. As a teenage boy and as a man in my early 20s, I started to do narrative therapy, which was looking at all of the stories that I had been telling myself about what it means to be a man, and particularly what it means to be a sexual man, what it means to be a man in the bedroom. And a lot of those stories were hindering my capacity for connection, my ability to communicate vulnerably and openly, and to ask for what it is that I wanted when it came to sexual experiences. So I was very thankful for doing that therapy process, because I could let go of a lot of those stories and start to rewrite the narrative, or rewrite the script, so to speak, about how I wanted to show up more authentically and genuinely as a man, but also as a sexual partner, as a lover. And that's been a turning point in my life, you know, and it's kind of the reason why I do the work that I do today, is from those formative conversations that I had with a very lovely therapist back at my college in America.
And it must be such a common experience. I'm thinking about, you know, the whole narrative of getting drunk and then hooking up is feels like it really aligns with the story that you're telling of your own past, Cam. How many of the men that you see have similar experiences, have similar anxieties to you?
Whenever I share that story in groups of men, 90% of the guys have some sort of resonance with that story. They tend to see themselves in that experience. And one of the things that we then like to talk about as a group of men is, you know, what are the ways that our version or our ideas of masculinity are inhibiting our capacity for connection and pleasure. And there's a variety of kind of myths that pop up around masculinity, which I think are worthwhile kind of unpacking, both for men, but also for people that have sex with men as well. And so when we start to get the ball rolling, I suppose we start to look at, you know, this emphasis on having to be the assertive, dominant, knowledgeable partner, and the pressure that brings with it, pressure that men typically place on their bodies around having to get an erection immediately, last a certain amount of time, have a certain size genitals, and again, just trying to unpack and let go of all of these expectations that have been placed upon men by themselves, but also from the social media influences that they watch that talk about masculinity, from the online pornography that they might watch, and the sexual scripts that are reinforced there. So there's really a lot of unlearning that men have to do, and that I've had to do in my own life. And then there's also unlearning that men's partners also have to do, because they get the same terrible sex education that Tanya alluded to previously. So it's an unlearning for both people in the relationship, or all people in the relationship, I suppose.
And Tanya, before we go to a caller standing by, I want to ask you that when you work with clients, you must have to look at other aspects of the relationship as well, because those dynamics will affect whether someone's comfortable about saying what they want in such an intimate situation.
Absolutely. Particularly if I'm working with couples, the first thing I do, I call it the foreplay for sex therapy, is to check how they communicate. Because if they can't communicate in the day-to-day about everyday things, how are they going to have difficult conversations about sex and intimacy? Because those topics are often labeled taboo by society or their family or their community or their religious groups. So we need to be able to give them, I guess, the muscles to be and the information and the techniques to get in and have a conversation about what it is that they might be feeling. Even if it's, I'm not very happy with how things are going, how can we start a conversation about that? So many people don't know what they want. They've never been asked, or they've never been told how their bodies work, or they've never experimented doing anything other than what they learned at school. So it's quite difficult when somebody says, well, okay, what would you like to do instead? You can be sitting there kind of looking like a goldfish going, oh, I'm not sure. You know, so encouraging learning and experimentation. I loved our previous caller's chat about their partner encouraging them to masturbate and explore their body and understand what works for them. So there are lots of conversations we can have around pleasure and exploration and sitting with what is possible rather than what's not possible. Because often as therapists, we meet people in the world of what's not possible and they're very frustrated and they're not happy with their sex life. And I go straight to what is working and what is possible. Let's focus there and expand from that.
Well, we have a caller in Sydney named Beverly, a beautiful name. Welcome to Life Matters, Bev.
Hi, Bev.
What do you want to say? You wanted to respond to the caller on duty sex.
Yes, I did. I feel like this whole conversation assumes that everybody wants to climax and everybody is looking for an increase in their sex life. And I've been with my partner for over 10 years and he has always had a much higher sex drive than me. He wants sex daily. And I, you know, in the early days would have been happy with 3 times a week and I would have been satisfied with that. But time and time again over the 10 years, I have told him less is more. And, you know, after working and housework and all of those kind of life demands, I just want to go to sleep. And it's like, it goes in one ear and out the other. And I've tried to have these, you know, healthy conversations about if it was less, then I would be more into it. But I just, it's like a service. It's duty. And I feel in this kind of space that I have to do it because if I don't, then he will potentially leave the relationship or have an affair, you know, and those old kind of myths that you have to, you know, keep him sexually happy in the bedroom. But it just, it doesn't feel like, you know, and if he does say, oh, well, I didn't ask you for sex last night, you know, having one night off a week is like, you know, he deserves a trophy.
Right.
So I don't want to paint him as a really bad person because he's wonderful in every single way, but he just is tone deaf. His body is saying something different and it just does not listen to my body.
Right. No, that's very well articulated, Bev. If I can ask a follow-up question before I go over to Tanya and Cam, when you do have sex with your partner, is it sex where it feels like it's an exchange, where you're feeling pleasure, or is it really kind of duty and he kind of just wants to do that deed?
It's very transactional. So I call it out. Like I say, well, you know, is this a transactional massage that you're offering me? Like I call a spade a spade. And it's almost a joke, you know. I just kind of like
lay. And that must and not feel very sexy, minutes. Hey, Bev?
No, it doesn't feel sexy
doesn't
at all.
Doesn't encourage you, right.
Yeah, but if I go away for a week or 2 weeks and I haven't, you know, being pestered for sex daily, then I am into it when I come back. Mm. Like less is more. Like I can enjoy it.
Tanya, being pestered for sex does not feel like a good thing, does it? What can you offer to Tanya to Bev?
Lots of things. My brain was going, I was listening to Beverly. Thanks so much for telling that story so wonderfully as well, because this is very common. And one of the first things I do when working with couples is to ask them to answer a few questions for me twice, right? So I ask them, how often would you like to be having sex? The first time is in an ideal world. And in an ideal world, we don't live in a porn film. It's just a good day, week, month, year where we're not tired, we're not stressed. And then also, how much sex would you like to be having in a good enough world? This is what I need to survive. Right. So it could be that your partner might want to have sex 7 days a week, but maybe good enough would be X number of days. We're not, pardon me, we're not sure. And it could be that Beverly would like to have sex, you know, ideally 3 times a week, but maybe good enough might even be once a month. Like it could be different. And when we look at that, we see the stretch and the ability to sort of compromise and communicate around that for the couple, then we need to talk about, well, what are we doing and how is that and how do we define sex? Because a lot of the time it comes down to penetrative sex only. And we I don't know why, but in long-term relationships and heterosexual couples, a lot of the time the beautiful creativity that we started out with kind of dwindles away until we're very, very focused on P and V sex and not much else. And that doesn't really work for folks with vulvas to keep them interested and aroused and having a nice time. And it kind of folds into that duty sex thing then, which is, look, I'm just going to do this and let's get it over with so that you will be in a better mood or you won't kick the dog or you won't be rude to the kids, because that stuff happens all the time. And what I do say to couples is it's very important for you to remember that you are not responsible for your partner's sexual pleasure and your partner is not responsible for your sexual pleasure. Each of us as individuals are, and we need to be able to advocate for that. And it really does need to be okay to say no without having ramifications or fears that somebody is going to leave you or do something terrible.
100%. Thank you for pointing that out. Cam, I want to come to you because I wonder if there are some tools, conversation tools, that you can equip Beverly with that she can take to her partner.
Yeah, that's a big ask. And you know, one of my roles is I do work with men that have used domestic violence, and my head automatically in that space goes to things like coercion and pressure and expectation around sex and intimacy. And so I just want to be mindful of not slipping down into that space too mm-hmm. much. But the, I guess the communication skills that I'd be recommending are around self-pleasure in a relationship, I suppose, right? One of the things that I try to encourage, particularly couples, but also the men that I work with who are in relationships, to have more conversations around is the role of self-pleasure, the role of masturbation, the role of fulfilling your own sexual needs solo in a relationship. There's a lot of baggage around masturbation for a lot of the men that I work with who are in relationships, and they feel like it's not something that they should be doing when they're in a relationship, or they feel a lot of guilt and shame around. But when there is a scenario where one partner is feeling reluctant or obliged to engage in sexual activity, then it's not conducive for long-term sexual satisfaction and sexual pleasure. So I'll be encouraging the men that I work with to find ways to explore their own pleasure by themselves, so they're not placing that expectation, that obligation, that duty onto their partners, because it's not fun to have sex with someone who doesn't want to be there, who doesn't want to, you know, be having sex with you in those moments. So
Take care of yourself, brother, is the overall advice. Let's go straight to Emily, who's in Victoria. You'd like to talk about how much your sex drive has been affected by perimenopause. Go ahead.
Good morning. Yes, it's quite a change from the big libido I once had to the dwindling tired libido that it's becoming.
How do you feel about that? Are you okay with it, or are you kind of miss that old self?
I miss the old self. I miss the energy and the things that came with it, but also the acceptance that, you know, this is a glorious journey into, you know, midlife. But you still miss it.
Yeah. Try to explore other ways to kind of ignite the libido? What are you thinking of? Like, what do you do?
I advocated very hard for testosterone, but I had to go to 4 doctors to get that. And that's made a big, I don't know, not big, but it's made a good increase.
Okay.
But it definitely has created, I've still got a mismatch with my partner who has a very healthy, very driven sex drive.
Yeah.
And would probably be happy to have it 7 days a week, where for me, I'd be like, 2 days a week is perfectly okay.
Seems to be, Tanya Kunz, that mismatch in relationships in terms of sex drive to be a very common theme that we're hearing across the calls. But Tanya, I'd like you to address testosterone, because I'm not very clear on what the impact is. And could you just explain a little bit about why testosterone might be used in this situation?
Yes, I can. A lot of people going through perimenopause can ask for testosterone, but also HRT treatment, so the hormone replacement, because at that time, women's bodies are, the hormonal balances are changing because they're preparing to no longer ovulate, so they don't need specific types of hormones happening and increasing and decreasing at certain times of the month. But as our caller said, that can impact our libido. It's not a permanent impact, I'd like to say. But, you know, a lot of people think, oh, menopause, that's the death of sex, or my sex drive will go down forever. For a lot of people, if they had a robust sex drive before menopause, it will come back. But often, you know, the symptoms of perimenopause are really not sexy. But things like testosterone can increase the innate sex drive a little more. It doesn't work for everybody, so I think that's why a lot of doctors are a bit reluctant. But, I mean, I also work with many trans clients, and when they start taking testosterone, they notice a significant boost in their libido, much to their surprise. So it can do that for a lot of people, and it can make things a little bit easier because, as we were saying, talking about things and trying to work out how to create that desire or how to come together can be really challenging for people who've been used to having more spontaneous sex and responding to that tingling in the loins rather than making decisions. But I'd like to say that making a decision to have sex is just as sexy as having the tingling in the loins. It's how we work about it and how we work with our bodies, because also our bodies are changing in perimenopause. So the things we like or the things we need might change. So we need to be curious about that and be chatting with our partners like, well, it's going to take me a little longer to arouse, or I might need to use more lubricant than normal, or these positions are no longer as great, but some of these other ones are now really working for me. Just sort of experimenting and seeing what's going on with our bodies.
Now, before we go on to our next set of calls and texts, I just want to come to Heated Rivalry because I did mention that we were going to talk about it at the top of the show. Tanya, I hear you laughing a little bit. I mean, from a sexuality perspective, how has heated rivalry met the moment? I mean, beyond the opportunity to collectively admire Connor's stories, shapely physique, why do you think that this show has become so popular?
I have a list of reasons here. I mean, I personally confess to being obsessed with the show as well. But every time I look at it, I see much more nuanced messages in there. I think it addresses toxic masculinity really well. It's set in a very masculine environment, in a sports environment, and we see men yearning. We see them being vulnerable. We see them showing fear. We see them showing emotions. We look at all of the women, all the female roles in that show are very positive and supportive and supporting everybody's sexuality. It's finally we've got a queer storyline where nothing bad happens. Nobody says no to them. Nobody shuts them down. It's their own fears that they're needing to come out and challenge. And then I was listening to Esther Perel, and she was like, watching this over and over and over again, like so many people are, is like corrective viewing. We're healing dysfunctional family experiences. We're healing dysfunctional relationships. We're teaching our nervous system what good things are and what they look like. And looking at the characters, people are asking for what they want. They're able to say no. They're modeling consent, and they're modeling intimacy in the very small details of how they interact. It's just got so many things.
Cam, what do you think men, queer and straight, and, you know, the whole range, could get out of watching the show?
I think there's a beautiful power exchange. The power dynamics between Hollander and Romanov are really fantastic. That's something I got out of the show, having watched it with my wife, is being able to see myself in the openness and the vulnerability, but also the assertiveness and the power from the way that these two men are kind of exploring their sexuality with one another. I think there's a really, as Tanya was saying, a really good model there for being able to talk confidently, but also quite vulnerably about your desire, about what it is that you want. I often hear from men that it's going to ruin the mood if they ask for consent, or that it's going to be difficult and awkward to kind of talk about your desires. And it really doesn't have to be. And I think there's a really good representation of how to explore the different roles, that kind of fluidity within, you know, power and dominance and assertiveness, but also softness and tenderness and emotionality that's in this show. And I think, yeah, there's a really good opportunity for men to learn from that.
Yeah, many television shows I've noticed make a point of modeling consent. You see that in Heated Rivalry, you see it in Bridgerton. It seems to be a real point in a lot of these modern shows where there is a lot of sex. This is Life Matters on Radio National. I'm Beverly Wang, and just to flag, content warning, we are talking about sex. We do have a lot of texts here, Cam and Tanya, so if you don't mind doing a bit of a lightning round, I might shoot through some of them and get your takes. One texter says, I think back in the day that fathers would take their sons to a prearranged lady of the night to learn. Very good idea to me, says the texter. Cam, what do you think?
I've heard stories like that, and, you know, without getting into the weeds of it, I think having an opportunity to be in a space where you're able to learn about sex with someone who is comfortable and confident, there is value in that. And also there's value in finding your sexuality through someone who's also at the same level as you and is able to kind of talk about their experience at the same time. So I don't know necessarily if, you know, going to a quote lady of the night is something that I would recommend for fathers, but having a conversation about sex in general is going to be the way to go forward.
Right. So that's the wording of the texter, not mine necessarily, sex worker. Mm-hmm. Tanya, do you think, you know, that mothers should be taking their daughters to learn about sex in that way?
I definitely think all parents should be speaking to all children about sex and sexuality and making it an open topic of conversation, not something that people have to cover their ears when a conversation is going on at home. I saw a brilliant program about UK sex education where they had 15-year-olds come into class and they said, after lunch, we're going to bring in some sex experts. You can ask any question you like. And the kids got really excited, wrote down all their questions, went off to lunch. And in the lunch break, they got the kids' parents in. And they told them the answers to the questions. And when the kids came back in all excited, they saw their parents there as the sex experts, and everybody nearly died. But after about 60 seconds of feeling uncomfortable, those people had absolutely brilliant conversations that would have been life-changing. So I encourage people to push through that little bit of awkwardness with their kids and to have open and honest conversations. They really will pay off.
Another texter says, I basically had a Catholic education with its ignorance and fear of sex attitudes. I'm in my late 70s, husband same age, has lost his libido due to prostate issues. I still masturbate regularly, helps in so many ways. Please discuss. So, Tanya, please discuss.
What are we going to discuss? I think that's wonderful. I think masturbation is a really healthy way of exploring our bodies. It's part of a sexual continuum. We have sex with partners, but we also have sex with ourselves. So I think it's part of our repertoire. I'm really glad to hear that the caller is doing that. I'm also curious about what they could be doing together with their partner. Have they been relying on penetrative type of sex? Because often with prostate issues, that can become difficult or no longer possible. But again, I'm going to ask the question, what is possible? Because you don't need to have a rock hard erection to be having a good quality and enjoyable sex life. There's lots of things that you can experience and enjoy genitally, physically, all over your body that feel lovely and keep you connected and would be considered sexual.
Cam, this one's for you. Most humans are hardwired for a variety of partners. Let's just face it. What's your response?
I don't think that it's necessary to believe in that. I think if you're someone who wants to explore a variety of partners, then find someone who's okay with you doing that. Find people that are okay with you doing that. If you're someone who wants to explore a monogamous long-term relationship, then you know, find someone who wants to explore that with you. I don't like to put people in boxes when it comes to what most people are going to do. Find something that's worthwhile for you specifically.
We are going to have to leave it there, but Cam Fraser, sex coach, sexologist, and deputy chair of the Australian Society of Sexologists, and Tanya Coons, clinical sexologist, who teaches sex therapists how to work with sexual issues. I want to thank you both for such an interesting conversation. There's clearly so much to cover, so we'll try to find some time to do it again. Thank you so much, and we are on to the aunties next.
Are you a PhD researcher, or do you know someone who is?
If so, it's time to apply for this year's ABC Top 5 Media Residencies.
This is an exceptional opportunity for early career researchers in the areas of science, humanities, and the arts.
You could spend 2 weeks with the ABC learning about the media and how to best communicate your important research to a wide audience.
Applications are now open through till April the 6th. For full details, search for ABC Top 5.
When a secret betrayal from beyond the grave comes knocking, it's definitely time to ask Auntie. And welcome to this week's Aunties, journalist and host of Away and the Radio National Arts Hour, Rudy Bremer. Hi, Rudy.
Hi, Bev.
And media trainer at the ABC, Rowan Barwick. Hi, Rowan.
Hi.
Rowan, first question is for you. Quick gut check before we get into the letter. Is it ever okay to read someone's diary?
Oh, yeah, that's a doozy. I would say no if they're alive. If they've passed on, yes.
Okay.
But there's probably some rules around that as well.
Okay, very good, very good. Rudy, same question to you.
Oh, look, as an arts reporter, I think I'm kind of a glorified professional gossip. So I'm fascinated by what people write in their diaries, and I would find it a little bit, I don't know, it's intriguing. I kind of would like to.
Okay.
And I'm also a fan of events where people go back to their old writing and read it for an audience.
Okay, so I'm going to take that as a sort of yes.
Maybe, sometimes.
Yeah, I would like to. All right, let's
hear. Two fence sitters, perhaps.
That's right. Let's hear from Gary, who's written in from Melbourne's eastern suburbs. And Gary writes, "Recently, my wife of 35 years passed away, and it's been incredibly hard. Finding the strength to just keep putting one foot in front of the other has been nearly impossible, as has been finding the ability to start actually putting away her things. But this month I began, and I came across her diaries. My wife was always journaling, and of course, I never would have dreamed of reading what she'd written while she was living. Now, though, I would give anything to have one more conversation with her, and her journals feel like a way to do that. So without thinking really, I started reading." Rudy, this comes to you and the fascination with diaries. Do you support Gary's opening up of his late wife's diaries?
I completely empathize with doing this. I was already kind of intrigued by the idea of reading someone's diary. And when you're missing them, I can see why you would want to.
Rowan, I mean, presuming you know nothing of what's to come, have you got any concerns at this point?
Look, I think that there's always the chance that you'll find out, or you'll experience something, or you'll learn something about that person that you didn't know before. But I mean, that's what's in a diary. But I think that as long as you're prepared for any surprises, it's probably okay. But it's a difficult one, because you might just want to keep that person as they are in your memory. And by reading the diary, you know, you're going into their very personal private thoughts that were never meant for anybody else. And, you know, for all of us, that's complex. So it's going into sort of reasonably dangerous territory, I would say. I would be nervous.
It's the intimate partner relationship, you know. You think you know your partner, but do you? If you were in the similar position, Rowan, would you do what Gary did?
I think I would. But I would want to just, you know, I'd want to brace myself for any surprises, be it about anything at all. I would just be a little bit sort of anxious and nervous and go forward with trepidation.
And Rudy, it sounds like if you were in the similar position, you'd go for it as well?
I think so. My dad keeps a diary and I've never read it, but there's a part of me that knows that one day I will.
Okay. Very intriguing. Okay. Dad is on notice. Get to redacting, Dad. Okay. Let's go back to Gary. So much of what my wife had written was how I remembered things. And so it didn't feel like I was betraying her trust by reading more. Actually, I fell into a kind of nostalgic haze. Then I came across a diary from the time she fell pregnant with our first child. And as I turned the pages, I realized what I was reading was essentially a chronicle of an affair. I knew she'd had an intensely emotional connection at that time with one of our mutual friends, but it turns out they were also lovers. On one hand, I feel a sense of acceptance. It was so long ago. On the other, I'd give anything to unread it. I feel hurt and angry and then incredibly guilty for feeling that way about her so soon after she passed. Well, I do believe, Auntie, this is the biggest bombshell that's ever been dropped in one of these letters. Rudy, this is a family secret from beyond the grave. How is this new information landing with you?
Oh, wow. I mean, every family has secrets. I know there are secrets in my own family. But it would definitely feel difficult.
Absolutely.
To learn something when you're still like quite freshly grieving by the sounds of it.
Rowan, Gary's having a lot of mixed emotions. If you were a friend of Gary, you are a friend of Gary, you're an auntie of Gary, what would you want to tell him right now?
I think I'm sort of also still feeling Rudy's shell shock on this, revelation, because this is big and difficult and huge. So I would want to be there for Gary and I would want to support Gary and talk it through. I think a revelation like this will take a lot of processing time and it probably won't be dealt with quickly. Like, you know, it will probably take years to process and develop, but you know, I think the friend needs to provide that support to be able to help Gary go through that process. But, I would just be there for him. I'm not sure what else you could do in this situation, to be honest.
Rudy, there's a lot of quite spicy detail in that section of the letter. What stood out to you most?
I have to say the thing that has stood out to me is that this is an affair that involved one of their mutual friends. And I'm now kind of thinking about how you grapple with that and cautioning that maybe don't try and have the conversation with that friend if they're still in your life.
Oh, I hadn't thought
until
of that.
You've
yeah.
thought about until you've really processed your feelings and you're really comfortable that you know what you want
relationship to be. We don't know the status of that mutual friend, but yes, that is a very good point. There is somebody out there who may hold another part of the story. But is it possible to betray the trust of someone who's died, Rudy? I'm just kind of wondering how Gary should reflect on the fact that he's reading something that was never meant for him.
Mm. I think it's actually quite healthy for us to have a complicated relationship with people after they've passed. I think this idea that we try and sanitize people's personalities and their memories within our lives purely on the basis that they've passed away isn't particularly helpful, and it's quite okay to remember them as a whole human being.
There's
a part of me that's kind of, if your relationship by the sounds of it has managed to get past this rough patch, then take that for the sign that this was take that for the love that it was.
Okay. You know? Let's go into Gary's final chapter. As well as working out what to do with these feelings, I now have another worry. When I first started reading her diaries, I so enjoyed the account of our lives that I mentioned them to our kids, and I told our eldest, who was closest with her mom. when I was reading about that time before her birth. This week, she asked if she could also read the diaries. Of course, I could come up with some excuse, but I think that would make her suspicious. Also, even if I avoid letting her read them, I feel like I may need to tell her that potentially I'm not her biological father. Goodness. What should I do, and how can I avoid feeling like I've betrayed my wife and am now potentially that I might betray my kids as well? Okay, team. This is a lot. Rowan, if you're Gary again, what you're being squeezed. What are you weighing up?
Look, I'm sort of in double shell shock now from the second or third bombshell revelation. There's so many revelations in this one. I think that Gary needs to process these first revelations in his own time. Mm. And once he has done that, I think it's okay, depending on how old the child is and the maturity of the child, I think he needs to then let the child know that this is what he found and let the child process it as well over time. But gosh, that's a tough conversation.
In the interim, Rowan, while Gary's taking the time to process, he's got an adult daughter who's knocking on his door saying, "Dad, where are the diaries? Why are you holding on to me?" What can he say to her in the meantime to bridge that gap?
I think he can say, "There's a lot in there that I need to process. And when I've processed that, I'm going to bring you in and we'll talk about it. But I'm not at the point now that I can talk about it." Possibly.
Like
that might buy him a little bit of time.
I think that's good. I like that, Rowan. You know what to say. Rudy, anything to add? What are your thoughts on what we've just revealed here?
I think Rowan's really onto it here with the first step is to kind of say, I need some time before we talk about it. I do think at this stage, any attempt to stop your daughter from reading the diary or to lie to her about it is not a useful way forward. Mm. So you definitely, maybe have the conversation about if you want to read this, understand that it might change the way that you think about your mother, relationship. You might rethink your relationship to some degree.
Well, and let's talk about the late wife, the late mother. This was a secret that she kept. And actually, we don't know for sure that he could be the biological father. It's just possibly through the timing. Do we have to think about honoring, you know, her wish to keep this secret at all at this point, Rowan?
I think it goes back to that original rule. If somebody's passed, it's okay to read their diary. And so, and now he knows this information. So he can't go back in time. He's read it. He needs to deal with this. And I think he really needs to share it with his daughter at an appropriate time. Once the dust has settled just a little bit, but that's a lot to deal with on so many levels.
Mm. Put yourself in Gary's shoes just for a second, Rowan. And you're thinking you've made this discovery. You're in a bit of a pickle. How do you feel about your initial decision to open the diaries to begin with?
I would still feel like it's the right decision because that diary exists. That person was so important in his life, of course, and it's okay to find out about the whole person, even though it's hard.
Rudy, final thoughts from you? The same question?
I think ultimately, if I was in this position, I would want to know.
Yeah.
I do think, Bev, you're right that we don't know for certain whether the child is biologically his or not.
Yep.
But I really want to remind people that we can also choose our family.
That's true. Thank you to Gary for sharing that bombshell of a dilemma with us. If you have a vexing dilemma that needs the auntie's help, having them talk it out can be very cathartic and very helpful. We are here for you. So please write it up and email it to lifematters@abc.net.au. We'll get our crew of aunties on the case. That email address again is lifematters@abc.net.au. A huge thank you to Life Matters producers who bring you all the stories and interviews that you hear across the week. They are brought Bronwyn O'Shea, Grace Pashley, Lucy Sweeney, and Beck Zajac. Our executive producer is Lachlan McIntosh, and our audio engineer is Carrie Dell. Remember, ABC Listen is your destination to catch up on all Life Matters conversations. Tap the heart to follow. You're all set. You'll never miss a thing. I'm Beverly Wang. Thanks for all your calls and messages. I'll catch you next time.